You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston College. Today is Sunday, September 13, 2026. Before we open this hour, let one truth stand firm in the air between us. What you hear today belongs solely to the voices speaking it, shaped by their lived experience, their research, and their refusal to soften reality. These reflections do not represent the official views of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. In this space, nothing is filtered to protect comfort, and nothing is shaped to satisfy institutions. Every word arrives unshielded, unpolished, and unapologetic. And with that clarity set, we step into This Week in Palestine. A broadcast where truth does not hesitate. It does not knock politely or wait for permission. Here, truth enters with its spine straight, its voice steady, and its presence impossible to ignore. Urgency is not decoration. It is the pulse behind every sentence, every report, every breath taken at this microphone. Clarity is not a luxury. It is the obligation we accept the moment we speak. Our heart beats in Palestine, in the alleys of Jerusalem, in the villages and towns of the West Bank, in the shattered streets of Gaza. Yet our vision reaches far beyond the borders carved by occupation or diplomacy. Because the forces shaping Palestinian life do not stop at checkpoints or concrete walls. They move through parliaments, through boardrooms, through the quiet corridors where powerful hands make decisions ordinary people must live with. Wherever you are listening, driving through the long hours of your shift, lifting your first cup of coffee into the morning light, or sitting in the stillness of your home, thank you for choosing to be here. I am your host and narrator, Maria Sultan. In this space, we do not file down the edges of truth. We do not bend the story to comfort those who prefer silence. We do not dilute reality for anyone's convenience. Here, truth stands unfiltered. Resistance is breath. Solidarity is lineage. And the voices rising from occupied land do not tremble. They rise beside movements across the world, demanding dignity, justice, and liberation. This hour is not simply a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread stretching from Palestine to every corner of the globe, binding devastation to determination, binding grief to a future still worth reaching for. Even in the deepest darkness, the spark of defiance survives. Even when the world turns away, that spark refuses to die. Each week, we bring you reporting that cuts through distortion analysis that refuses disguise, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, complexity, and unbroken courage. We speak with intention, because the stakes demand nothing less.
This week in Palestine is not a refuge for polite silence. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without hesitation. The struggle for freedom is shared. It crosses borders, and it remains sacred.
Today, we revisit a war whose battles ended decades ago, but whose narrative still shapes the Middle East now. A war retold, reframed, and repurposed by governments that needed its memory more than its victory. A war where Arab armies fought to reclaim occupied land, while the world was taught a different story. This documentary unravels the truth behind the Yom Kippur War and the long shadow it still casts today.
The war that did not end in 1973, a war that continues in textbooks, in speeches, in political campaigns, in military doctrines, and in the collective memory of millions across the Middle East. The Yom Kippur War, known in the Arab world as the October War, is not just a military conflict. It is a story, a narrative, a battlefield of memory.
And for 50 years, that memory has been contested, reshaped, weaponized, and retold by governments, institutions, and political movements that needed the war to mean something specific. Today, we peel back the layers. Today, we examine what happened and what was said to have happened. Today, we explore why Arab states insisted they acted in self-defense, and why the official Western narrative framed the war as an unprovoked attack.
This is not a retelling of propaganda. This is an investigation into how propaganda was built. To understand the October War, we must understand the years before it.
The Six-Day War of 1967 left Egypt, Syria, and Jordan devastated. Territories were lost, borders were redrawn, refugees multiplied. And the Arab world watched as Israel expanded its control over Sinai, Gaza, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights. For Arab states, 1967 was not just a defeat. It was an occupation, a humiliation, a wound that demanded healing.
Egypt's president, Anwar Sadat, inherited a nation suffocating under the weight of loss. Syria's Hafez al-Assad inherited a nation burning for revenge. Jordan struggled to survive. Palestinians lived under military rule. The world saw borders. Arabs saw homes. The world saw strategic positions. Arabs saw land taken by force. The world saw a ceasefire. Arabs saw a temporary pause in a war that had never ended.
And so, the stage was set.
Arab leaders argued that the October War was not an act of aggression, but an act of reclamation. Egypt insisted it had the right to retake Sinai. Syria insisted it had the right to retake the Golan Heights. Both insisted that international law recognized their claims. For years, Egypt attempted diplomacy. Sadat sent messages to Washington. He offered negotiations. He offered recognition. He offered peace in exchange for withdrawal. He was ignored.
Sadat later said, "I knocked on every door. No one listened." Syria argued that Israel's presence on the Golan Heights was not just occupation, it was a strategic threat. The high ground gave Israel the ability to strike Damascus in minutes. Arab states argued that waiting meant losing. Waiting meant accepting occupation. Waiting meant surrender. And so, they prepared.
Not for conquest, but for what they called the restoration of stolen land. Western narratives often describe the October War as a surprise attack. But the truth is more complicated. Israel knew war was coming. Its intelligence services warned of troop movements. Its analysts saw the buildup. Its generals debated mobilization.
But Israel believed Egypt would never attack without air superiority. Israel believed Syria would never attack without Egypt. Israel believed Arab armies were too weak, too demoralized, too divided. Israel believed its own myth of invincibility.
And so, when Egyptian and Syrian forces launched their coordinated assault on October 6, 1973, crossing the Suez Canal and storming the Golan Heights, the shock was not that war had begun. The shock was that Arab armies were winning.
Egyptian forces crossed the canal under a wall of anti-aircraft missiles that neutralized Israel's air advantage. They established bridgeheads. They advanced into Sinai. They shattered the belief that Israel could not be challenged. Syrian forces surged across the Golan Heights, pushing Israeli units back toward the Jordan River. For the first time since 1967, Israel faced the possibility of losing territory. Arab capitals erupted in celebration. For the first time in years, they felt dignity.
But war is not won in days. Israel mobilized. The United States intervened. Weapons flowed. Intelligence flowed. Diplomatic pressure mounted. The tide turned. As the war shifted, so did the story. Western governments framed the conflict as an attack on Israel during a religious holiday. They emphasized timing. They emphasized surprise. They emphasized vulnerability.
Arab states framed the conflict as a liberation war. They emphasized occupation. They emphasized international law. They emphasized self-defense. Two narratives emerged. Israel was attacked. Arabs were reclaiming land.
Both narratives contained truth. Both narratives contained omission. Both narratives served political needs. And the world chose sides.
After the ceasefire, the battle moved from the battlefield to the media. Governments crafted stories. Textbooks were rewritten. Documentaries were produced. Speeches were delivered. Israel emphasized survival. Arab states emphasized justice. Israel emphasized existential threat. Arab states emphasized territorial rights. Israel emphasized surprise. Arab states emphasized provocation.
And Western institutions overwhelmingly adopted the Israeli framing, not because it was inherently more accurate, but because it aligned with Cold War alliances, political interests, and domestic pressures. The war became a symbol, a myth, a narrative of heroism, betrayal, fear, and triumph. But beneath the myth lay a simple truth. Arab states attacked because they believed diplomacy had failed. Israel defended because it believed its survival was at stake. And the world chose the version that suited its politics.
The October War reshaped the Middle East. Egypt regained dignity and later regained Sinai through diplomacy. Syria never regained the Golan Heights. Israel learned that its military superiority was not absolute. The United States learned that its alliances came with consequences. The Arab world learned that unity could change history, even briefly. But the narrative of the war became more powerful than the war itself. It shaped peace treaties. It shaped military doctrines. It shaped political movements. It shaped public memory.
And today, the war is still fought, not with tanks, but with words. Why does the narrative matter? Because narratives justify policy. Narratives justify occupation. Narratives justify military budgets. Narratives justify alliances. Narratives justify fear. If the war was an unprovoked attack, then Israel's subsequent policies appear defensive. If the war was an act of reclamation, then Arab grievances appear justified.
History becomes a weapon. Memory becomes a battlefield. Narrative becomes power. And the October War remains one of the most contested memories in modern history. Today, the legacy of the October War still shapes Israeli military doctrine, Egyptian political identity, Syrian territorial claims, American foreign policy, Arab public memory, regional alliances, the Palestinian struggle, the geopolitics of the Middle East.
The war is not over. It lives in speeches. It lives in textbooks. It lives in negotiations. It lives in the minds of millions. And today, we revisit it, not to choose a side, but to understand how sides were chosen.
Here is my conclusion. The War of Truth. The October War was a military conflict, but its aftermath was a political war, a media war, a war of memory. Arab states insisted they acted in self-defense. Israel insisted it was attacked. The world chose the narrative that suited its interests. And today, we examine the war not to rewrite history, but to reveal how history was written.
Because understanding the October War is not about the past. It is about the present. It is about how nations justify their actions. It is about how narratives shape reality. It is about how memory becomes power. And now, the story stands before you, ready for anyone who reads it, today or years from now. Because the war of memory never ends.
So, let's turn to Isaac Zeil, whose investigation cuts straight through decades of political myth-making. His documentary reopens the story of the Yom Kippur War and exposes how its narrative was shaped, reframed, and weaponized. So now, let's listen together to how Zionists lie about the Yom Kippur War. It was Arab self-defense.
On October 6, 1973, Egypt and Syria waged a campaign against Israeli forces in the occupied Sinai Peninsula and Golan Heights. Of all the Arab-Israeli wars, I would argue that this is the most misunderstood because, despite it being a clear instance of resistance to colonial occupation, Zionists have so thoroughly hijacked the narrative to paint the Israelis as the poor little victims of senseless Arab aggression, while skirting past any inconvenient questions, like why was Israel in possession of Egyptian and Syrian land in the first place? Were there any diplomatic off-ramps that Israel chose to ignore in the lead-up to the war that ultimately made it inevitable? Why was Israel building civilian settlements in the land it stole from its neighbors when that's a clear violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention and a war crime? The dishonesty surrounding this war has gotten so bad that you can't even do a simple YouTube search for videos about it without being smothered by Zionist mythology.
Imagine being attacked at the moment you are the most vulnerable.
73, holiest day of the Jewish calendar, Yom Kippur, everybody is fasting, everybody is praying, and a surprise attack is launched on the state of Israel.
The holiest day of the Jewish year, synagogues in Israel were filled with Jews fasting and praying. Then at precisely 2 p.m., air raid sirens started to blare.
Even the prevalent name used to describe this war, the Yom Kippur War, is a subtle propaganda tool used to subconsciously frame it as though the barbarous Arabs decided to attack helpless Israelis on a Jewish holiday as some sort of microcosm of a broader religious conflict, when in reality the war, which I'll refer to as the October War from this point forward, was a national liberation struggle waged by Egypt and Syria to free their own lands from illegal Israeli occupation. By the end of this video, it should be clear that Zionists present a version of events that is incongruous with the historical record, while refusing to grapple with the glaring holes in their own narrative. I'm here to attempt to correct the record. It may come as a surprise to hear that this video is less about the actual October War and the way it played out on the battlefield, and much more about everything leading up to the war, the political situation that encompassed it, and the Israeli intransigence that made it inevitable. Quick disclaimer, throughout this video, I'll be substantiating many of my arguments by appealing to international law. It's not because I typically place much value in its authority. I see international law as a cudgel that's often used by the West and its allies to subjugate their geopolitical adversaries through a lopsided application of legal principles whenever it's politically convenient. That said, in the case of the October War and everything leading up to it, I think citing international law may help me get through to people who are on the fence and place more faith in the supposed rules-based order than I do. Basically, what I'm saying is I don't care all that much about legal arguments because they can sometimes fall short when it comes to assessing the ethical dimensions of a situation, but I'll be making them throughout this video anyway, both to appeal to a broader audience and to add an additional layer to strengthen my overall argument, With that said, let's get on with the video. To fully understand the dynamics and environment surrounding the 1973 October War, we actually have to start 6 years earlier, in 1967, when Israel decided to wage a war of aggression against its neighbors and begin its occupation of Egyptian, Syrian, and Palestinian territory. So, despite the fact that I've already covered the 67 war on this channel, I do need to reiterate it because it's inextricably linked to the subject at hand, and without a thorough understanding of Israel's criminal behavior during that war, we're unable to holistically understand the 73 October War. In the spirit of full transparency, here is exactly how this video is laid out, so you know what you're getting into. We'll start with the 1967 Six-Day War and all of the mythology surrounding it. Then we'll move on to Security Council Resolution 242, which is incredibly important to understand since it forms the bedrock of the international consensus on the peace process in the MENA region. Any serious discussion about diplomacy between Israel and its neighbors cannot ignore this resolution. From there, we'll cover the War of Attrition, Israeli diplomatic intransigence, and finally, the 1973 October War itself. These segments will be marked with timestamps below if you want to skip around, though I recommend watching the video in its entirety for the fullest understanding of the topic. The road to the Six-Day War was marked by border skirmishes, water disputes started and then exacerbated by Israeli diversion projects, and overall tensions between Israel and its neighbors. Keep in mind that at this point, Israel was still fairly new to the region and remained in an active state of belligerency with its neighbors dating back to the First Arab-Israeli War of 1948, a war that unfolded in the context of Israeli forces ethnically cleansing hundreds of thousands of Palestinians and then ethnically cleansing hundreds of thousands more after the Arab states invaded to intervene. So, despite the fact that the 1948 war ended with an armistice agreement, a ceasefire, the broader state of belligerency between Israel and its neighbors remained because a formal peace treaty was never concluded. There was some debate in the early 50s that since the ceasefire had a quote-unquote permanent character, that it was considered to have ended the state of belligerency between the parties, but any legitimacy that that argument once held was thrown out the window when Israel decided to launch a colonial war of aggression and invade Egypt in 1956, leading the government of then-Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion to denounce the Egypt-Israeli armistice as beyond repair, effectively abrogating it and reimposing the state of belligerency. This is an important detail since being in an active state of belligerency allows the parties involved to withhold certain peacetime rights from one another if they so choose. Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser had no qualms about doing exactly that and arguing that he was legally entitled to his actions despite the fact that the Israelis disagreed with his assessment, as we'll dive deeper into shortly. Moreover, the Israeli-Syrian border was by far the most tumultuous front in the lead-up to the 1967 Six-Day War. According to a posthumously released 1976 interview with the infamous Israeli general and former defense minister Moshe Dayan, roughly 80% of the clashes along the Syrian border on the eve of the Six-Day War were sparked by Israeli aggression. It also didn't help that Syria and Egypt were bound by a mutual defense pact at that time, meaning Israeli provocations against Syria made some form of Egyptian response all but inevitable. It was in this environment that, in May 1967, Nasser moved his troops into the Sinai Peninsula, restricted the Straits of Tiran to Israeli shipping, and requested the removal of the UN Emergency Force from the Sinai. Then, on June 5, 1967, Israel launched a surprise attack against its neighbors, destroyed their air forces on the tarmac, securing air superiority for the remainder of the war, and went on to capture roughly 70,000 square kilometers of territory, effectively tripling its size. Israel later went on to argue that it was acting in anticipatory self-defense when it waged this war, and it had no choice but to attack its neighbors with a preemptive strike. Now, you may be thinking, well, Isaac, that kind of sounds like Nasser was the aggressor, no? And to that, I'd like to quote the former Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin, who was part of the Israeli cabinet in 1967, and who can give us some insight into the thought process of the Israelis at the time. In June 1967, we again had a choice. The Egyptian army concentrations in the Sinai approaches do not prove Nasser was really about to attack us. We must be honest with ourselves. We decided to attack him. So really quickly, let's put this situation under a microscope and analyze Nasser's decisions leading up to the war so you could see that, despite his bellicose posturing and arguably arrogant behavior, his actions were grounded in a reasonable rationale, starting with, but Nasser moved his troops into Sinai and declared that he would invade Israel. No, he actually didn't formally declare war against Israel. He threatened conditional war if Israel kept aggressing against Syria or threatened Egypt. This, by the way, is a little something known as self-defense. Remember that Egyptian-Syrian mutual defense pact I told you about? Well, that was signed in late 1966, and shortly after, Israel escalated tensions by shooting down six Syrian MIGs while prominent Israeli officials were hinting at their aspirations to overthrow the Syrian government. It didn't help that Nasser was given a faulty intelligence report by the Soviets claiming that Israel was planning an assault on Syria, but setting the accuracy of that report aside, it wasn't unreasonable for him to assume the worst of the Israelis when it came to the Syrian front, given the aforementioned admission from Moshe Dayan that Israel had instigated about 80% of the clashes there during the time period in question. When it came to Nasser's troop concentrations in the Sinai, this was his attempt at a strategy known as brinkmanship, which was meant primarily to serve a political, not military purpose. Funnily enough, Nasser's decision to do this was more so motivated by his rivalry with the conservative Arab monarchies in the region, which were taunting him for supposedly being too lenient on Israel and hiding behind UN forces. As historian Avi Schlaim noted, there is general agreement among commentators that Nasser neither wanted nor planned to go to war with Israel. What he did was to embark on an exercise in brinkmanship that was to carry him over the brink. To complement Nasser's brinkmanship, he was explicitly assuring the UN Secretary General, U Thant, that he was not going to strike Israel. As scholar of international law and author of The Six-Day War on Israeli Self-Defense, Professor John Quigley noted, President Nasser assured U Thant that the UAR would not stage a preemptive attack against Israel. Nasser was still insisting that his actions related to the Israel-Syria situation. He said at a news conference in Cairo, "We could not remain silent in the face of threats to Syria or any aggression against her. Neither Thant nor any of the major powers thought Egypt would initiate hostilities." Believe it or not, this was actually the position of many prominent Israeli and American officials at the time as well. U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara told Israel's foreign minister, Abba Iban, that Israel was not in any danger as an Egyptian attack was not imminent. U.S. President Lyndon B. Johnson agreed with this assessment and added that Israel would actually whip the hell out of its opponents if war ensued. Given that Nasser had a third of his military bogged down in Yemen at this time, it should have been no secret that this was the case and that Egypt was obviously not trying to initiate a war while so ill-prepared. At the same time, the head of Israel's own intelligence service, Mossad, agreed with the US assessment and told McNamara there was no differences between the US and the Israelis on the military intelligence picture or its interpretation, confirming that the Israeli body that is literally tasked with assessing such situations knew that Israel was not in any danger in 1967. You also had Yitzhak Rabin, then a general, acknowledging that Nasser's concentrations were defensive in character and that the Israeli leadership at the time of the war knew this, an assessment he shared with his fellow Israeli generals such as Izer Weizman, the commander of the Air Force, who also argued that Israel was not in any danger. But the most damning admission of Israeli guilt comes from the sitting Israeli prime minister at the time of the Six-Day War, Levi Eshkol, who outright admitted that he didn't think Nasser was trying to wage war, only to immediately switch gears and help invent a fake story claiming Egypt attacked first so Israel would appear to be the victim in the fog of war and the UN wouldn't force a ceasefire. Then, once Israel had achieved its military objectives, Eshkol and his government abandoned that lie. It was then and only then that the Israelis ditched their original claim that Egypt struck first and embraced the now infamous narrative that they had launched a preemptive strike in self-defense. Now you tell me, if Israel's waging of this war was genuinely predicated on self-defense, why would the sitting Israeli prime minister at the time have to help make up a fake cover story about Egypt striking first when he knew that it didn't? And why would all of these prominent Israeli and US officials agree that Nasser wasn't actually trying to wage war and Israel was not in any danger? Maybe it's because Israel was actually the aggressor here. Now, you may rebut that by arguing, well, Nasser expelled the UN Emergency Force from Sinai in May of 1967. Why would he do that if he didn't want war? And the answer to that is pretty simple. But first, we have to understand how and why this UN Emergency Force ended up on his soil in the first place. See, after Israel illegally invaded Egypt in 1956 during the Suez Crisis, the UN requested in 1957 that an emergency force be stationed in both Egypt and Israel to keep the peace and ensure that Israeli ships could pass through the Straits of Tehran. Nasser agreed to this arrangement, while Israel refused to host a UN emergency force on its soil. This was actually such a blatantly bad faith move by Israel that even US Secretary of State John Foster Dulles complained to his UN ambassador that Israel is very much in the wrong. The UN Security General should make clear Israel's refusal to agree to this. He should press this point hard in public and make it clear to all the world. So when you fast forward to May 1967, Nasser is simply matching Israel's energy. In fact, Egypt explicitly pointed out the double standard, putting forth the idea that if Israel was genuinely feeling threatened by Egypt's removal of the UN emergency force from Sinai, it could make its own territory available, as it was asked to do in the past. But when Youth Ant proposed that solution to Israel's UN ambassador, Gideon Raphael, Raphael said this would be entirely unacceptable to the Israeli government. There's also the aforementioned fact that Nasser's conservative rivals in the region were mocking him for supposedly hiding behind UN forces, as we've already been over. Now finally, the most common argument Zionists make to absolve Israel for waging war in 1967. Nasser closed the Straits of Tehran to Israeli shipping, which the Israelis argued constituted a cause for war. Now, in order to understand this move from Nasser, we have to go back to 1956, when Israel illegally invaded Egypt and only withdrew from Egyptian territory after Egypt accepted the aforesaid UN emergency force to be stationed in Sharm el-Sheikh to physically guarantee free Israeli passage through the Straits of Tehran and in and out of the Gulf of Aqaba. Prior to Israel's 1956 invasion, as we've already been over, Nasser pointed to the overarching state of war between Israel and Egypt to justify refusing Israel its peacetime rights, including free passage through Egypt's territorial waters. Since no formal peace treaty was signed after the 48 war and only a ceasefire was put in place, Nasser argued that he was legally entitled to do this. His argument only became substantially stronger after Israel invaded his country in 1956 because from that point on, not even the Israelis could plausibly pretend that Nasser owed them peacetime rights. Anyway, to legally solidify Israel's access through the Straits of Tehran, a highly specific provision was drafted into the 1958 Convention on the Territorial Sea in the Contiguous Zone. Article 16.4 of this convention explicitly expanded the traditional definition of a strait to accommodate the Straits of Tehran. Believe it or not, the Straits of Tehran, despite their name, weren't clearly legally considered straits at the time because they don't connect two open high seas, which was the legal requirement. Instead, they connected the high seas to the Gulf of Aqaba and then Israeli territorial waters while running through sovereign Egyptian territorial waters. It was because of this, Nasser argued that Egypt had the right to assert belligerent jurisdiction and refuse Israeli peacetime access through Egyptian territorial waters. So this broader, expanded definition of a strait put forth in Article 16.4 of the convention was specifically designed to accommodate Israel by making the Straits of Tehran fit the definition of a waterway that Nasser could no longer suspend passage through on security grounds. Nasser, aware of the political motivations of those who drafted this convention, refused to ratify it and was not legally bound to it. As Quigley summarized, even if the expanded definition of a strait in Article 16.4 did reflect customary law, that norm would not necessarily bind Egypt. A state that indicates its descent from a practice while the law is developing is not bound. Egypt clearly expressed dissent. Leading legal experts, including Arthur Dean, who chaired the US delegation at the drafting conference, and British scholar Rosalind Higgins, acknowledged that the expanded definition of a strait was a new rule and did not represent existing customary international law. Despite Nasser's disagreement with the 1958 convention and his grounded legal justification for dissenting from it, the Straits of Tehran nevertheless remained open, thanks to the UN emergency force stationed at Sharm el-Sheikh, until May 23, 1967, when following the evacuation of the UN force at Nasser's request, the Straits were restricted to Israeli shipping. This wasn't actually a blockade, as Zionists claim. Nasser just imposed shipping restrictions. To quote Quigley again, a blockade involves positioning vessels off the coast of an adversary state with a threat to use force against vessels that try to sail through. Egypt was imposing restrictions within its own territorial waters, not offshore another state. Blockade is said to involve the blocking of men of war of the approach to the enemy coast or part of it for the purpose of preventing ingress and egress of vessels or aircraft of all nations. Vessels of all nations are prevented from entering or leaving regardless of their cargo. The Egyptian restrictions involved only two categories of vessel. One, Israeli flag vessels, and two, vessels flagged elsewhere carrying strategic goods to Israel. The Egyptian restrictions may have constituted what is called interdiction of contraband, a lesser form of restriction. Interdiction of contraband does not rise to the level of aggression. Once the UNEF force left and Egyptian troops took their place, Nasser simply implemented these restrictions, and contrary to popular mythology, in late May 1967, Nasser did actually entertain diplomatic proposals to resolve the Straits crisis peacefully with Israel without resorting to war. Israel rejected or ignored every single one. For example, Egypt signaled a willingness to submit the dispute to the International Court of Justice or International Arbitration. In fact, Nasser even had his legal team draft up papers to prepare for a proposal at the ICJ. Nasser accepted a temporary UN proposal to de-escalate the crisis, and he even offered to send his deputy to Washington for talks. None of these efforts were allowed to play out because Israel launched its surprise attack before a diplomatic resolution could be reached. As is recounted by Israeli former foreign minister Shlomo Ben-Ami in his book Scars of War, Wounds of Peace, at the end of May 1967, a last attempt at international mediation was made by both the UN's Secretary General and the Americans. Nasser was not negative, and he presumably did not reject the idea of a breathing space in which peaceful traffic could be allowed in the Straits. He was ready to send his deputy to Washington to discuss such an avenue to a possible compromise. The American Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, would later write in his memoirs that we had a good chance to de-escalate the crisis. Whether an agreement could eventually have been reached is nevertheless extremely doubtful. What was certain was that Diane's appointment and Israel's irrevocable decision to strike cut short this last-minute peace overture. Israel claimed that the closure of the Straits constituted an armed attack and therefore a cause for a war. Now, as per international law, there are very few ways to legally resort to force. Article 2 of the UN Charter strictly prohibits states from using or threatening to use force against each other's political independence or territorial integrity. But Article 51 offers a loophole and permits the use of force only if a member state is acting in self-defense against a, quote, armed attack. Back in 1967, the wording of Article 51 was generally interpreted quite literally. Resorting to force in self-defense was only permitted if an actual armed attack had occurred. Much of the modern legal framework we rely on today to interpret an armed attack was developed after the Six-Day War, including the ICJ's 1986 Nicaragua versus United States judgment, the UN General Assembly's 1974 definition of aggression, Resolution 3314, and the 1994 San Remo Manual. As a result, many international lawyers at the time interpreted armed attack according to the plain text of Article 51, with some scholars outright warning against stretching its meaning beyond its literal wording. So despite this shaky footing, this is where Israel tried to make its legal argument by claiming that the closure of the Straits constituted an armed attack and warranted an Israeli invasion. However, aside from everything I just mentioned, our understanding of preemptive strikes or anticipatory self-defense is shaped by the 1837 Caroline test, which holds that a preemptive strike is only lawful if the threat is imminent and the necessity of that self-defense is instant, overwhelming, and leaving no choice of means and no moment for deliberation. Obviously, that wasn't the case in June 1967. As we've already gone over, many prominent Israeli figures admitted that there was no danger. Nasser was actively engaging in diplomacy, which Israel ignored, instead launching a war in violation of another provision of the UN Charter, Article 33, which explicitly requires states to exhaust peaceful means and diplomacy before resorting to force. Another way to legally resort to force would be to receive a mandate from the UN Security Council, as per Article 42 of the UN Charter. Israel failed here too. On top of all of this, Leonard Meeker, the US State Department's then legal advisor, tasked with assessing the Straits of Tehran crisis, conceded that Nasser's closure did not constitute an armed attack. Funnily enough, he even argued that if Nasser had mined the strait and an Israeli ship had struck one of those mines, it still probably wouldn't have constituted an armed attack. But the real cherry on top is that the Straits of Tehran weren't even that important to the Israeli economy. Israel wanted them open largely as a matter of political principle and strategic leverage. The head of Mossad himself admitted to Robert McNamara that passage through the Straits of Tehran was not crucial for Israel. Now, you may think it was a little unnecessary for me to go over all of that, especially since my last video already covered pretty much everything I said, and you might be right. But I did it for a reason, to leave absolutely no ambiguity that Israel waged an illegal war of aggression in 1967, and that it was in the context of that expansionist act that it seized and occupied the Golan Heights, which were stolen on the fifth day of the war when Syria was not threatening Israel and abiding by the UN-imposed ceasefire, as well as the Sinai Peninsula, East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza. And if this wasn't bad enough, Israel also started building civilian settlements in these territories almost immediately, in direct violation of international law, including Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which bars an occupying power from transferring its civilian population into territories it occupies, and understands said act of colonialism to be a war crime. By driving home the point that these territories were conquered in an illegal war of aggression and then colonized in violation of international law, we're able to properly understand the political situation on the eve of the 1973 October War. But we're not quite there yet. In the aftermath of the Six-Day War on November 22, 1967, UN Security Council Resolution 242 was passed, completely reshaping the dynamic between Israel and its neighbors and becoming the backbone of the region's peacemaking in the international consensus. The resolution was primarily drafted by Lord Caradon, the British ambassador to the UN, and it sought to establish a framework for a just and lasting peace in the MENA region on the basis of the Land for Peace formula. 242 rested on the fundamental legal principle of the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war, meaning, if you acquire a bunch of territory in a war, you gotta give it back. 242's goal was to legally mandate the removal of Israeli forces from the territories it stole during the Six-Day War in exchange for peace and recognition from its neighbors. Now, there are two massive controversies pertaining to Security Council Resolution 242. The first of which, and I would argue that this is the most severe, is that it completely ignores the national aspirations of the Palestinians. It reduces their plight down to a mere refugee problem, and fundamentally writes them out of the broader Arab-Israeli conflict as a distinct national group. That's actually why historian Rashid Khalidi refers to 242 as the third declaration of war on Palestine, just behind the Balfour Declaration of 1917 and the UN partition proposal of 1947, and it's why Noam Chomsky outright denounces 242 as rejectionist. Now, the second controversy surrounding Resolution 242 is the strategically vague wording in its English version. This phenomenon, known as constructive ambiguity, is a linguistic tactic often used in legal drafting to give the parties involved a sense of compromise, making them more likely to accept the document in question. But when it comes to the language of Resolution 242, the Israeli engagement is not simply flawed due to the vague wording of the document, it's entirely bad faith. See, the English translation of Resolution 242 calls for the withdrawal of Israel armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. The issue pertains to the fact that this language version of the document does not say from the territories occupied in the recent conflict. Israel points to this to argue that it should get to pick and choose which territories it can occupy instead of withdrawing from them all, which was the impression that Egypt, Jordan, the US, and pretty much the entire international community was under when the resolution passed. And if this wasn't slimy enough, then Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Iban was actually lobbying Lord Caradon as he was drafting the resolution to remove the word "the" before the phrase "territories occupied," and Iban also requested the removal of the preamble which stipulated the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war. This is a pretty important historical detail. The Israelis were literally manipulating the drafting process with the goal to engineer the resolution's language to the point where it could be stretched to justify Israeli expansionism. I mean, Iban practically admitted as much in his memoir, Personal Witness, where he reminisces about 242 giving Israel the, quote, chance of territorial revision. Kind of weird, since the whole point of the fucking resolution was to not allow for territorial revision. Anyway, Iban was successful in getting Caradon to agree to one of his requests, the removal of the definite article from the English version's withdrawal phrase, but Caradon refused to remove the preamble. Despite the fact that Caradon caved to Iban's request, he still assured the Arabs that all the territories is what 242 actually meant, At the time, the U.S. also agreed that 242 meant Israel had to give back all the land it stole with, if anything, minor and mutual modifications. Not just some of it. U.S. Ambassador Arthur Goldberg explicitly told Jordan's King Hussein that America could guarantee that everything would be returned by Israel. And U.S. Secretary of State Dean Rusk corroborated this. It really wasn't until Kissinger became a prominent voice on Israel-related foreign policy in the late 60s and early 70s that the U.S. changed its interpretation of the document and argued that the wording actually does allow Israel to cherry-pick which territories it withdraws from. But we'll get into that later. The important thing to understand here is that it was specifically under this original interpretation that Egypt, Jordan, and most of the world hopped on board with Security Council Resolution 242. To add insult to injury, the other language versions of the resolution, like the French and Spanish ones, don't harbor the ambiguous wording and state clearly that Israel has to withdraw from all the territories it occupied in 1967. Not just some, but Abba Iban stated that Israel would only consider the English version of the document to be binding, despite the fact that all official UN language versions are equally authoritative. As Rashid Khalidi put it, Israel has driven a coach and horses through this linguistic gap, which has permitted it to colonize the occupied Palestinian and Syrian territories. And if it isn't yet crystal clear just how bad faith the Israelis were and still are when it comes to their interpretation of Resolution 242, international lawyer John McHugo, in his paper on the matter, makes some excellent arguments to invalidate Israel's behavior. He uses the document's own syntax and logic to expose the absurdity of Israel's argument. He brings up paragraph 2A of the resolution, which guarantees freedom of navigation through international waterways in the area. He points out that here too, the words all and the are missing before international waterways, and he argues, there are a number of international waterways in the area. The Suez Canal, the Straits of Tehran at the entrance of the Gulf of Aqaba, and the Bab el-Mandeb at the entrance of the Red Sea. Area is undefined. Does it cover some or all of these waterways? If all waterways are not intended to be covered by the phrase, a major lack of clarity emerges. This cannot have been the intention. Good faith and the natural and only meaning require that the sense all international waterways be implied. If all is to be implied here, surely it should be implied in the withdrawal phrase. I say all of this to say, Israel deliberately engaged with Security Council Resolution 242 in bad faith. It chose to interpret the lack of a definite article in the withdrawal clause, which it lobbied for during the drafting process, in the most convenient way possible so it could maintain its illegal occupation, while simultaneously expecting the other parties to look past the absence of a definite article in other provisions, such as the one concerning open waterways, because Israel benefited from them doing so. This is the type of behavior that is explicitly denounced in Articles 31 and 32 of the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, which states, a treaty shall be interpreted in good faith in accordance with the ordinary meaning to be given to the terms of the treaty in their context and in the light of its object and purpose. If 242's object and purpose is to assert the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war, as its preamble states, then why the fuck would Israel choose to interpret it in a way that allows for the acquisition of some territory by war? That makes no sense. Anyway, almost immediately after Resolution 242 passed, the peace process froze due to these conflicting interpretations of how it was meant to be implemented. From 1968 to 1969, the parties entered a full-blown deadlock. Israel persisted in its refusal to interpret the resolution in good faith and work towards a withdrawal from all of the land it had seized. Instead, it entrenched its occupation of the territories, almost immediately began filling them with its own civilian settlers in a brazen act of colonialism, and remained intransigent. Another war was becoming increasingly inevitable. In early 1969, Golda Meir took over as Israeli Prime Minister following the death of Levi Eshkol. She notoriously had a propensity for intransigence, and this ended up being her Achilles heel. She gave the military far too much influence, and as historian Avi Schlaim noted, nowhere was Golda's self-righteousness more conspicuous than in relation to the Arab world. Her attitude to the Arabs was based on emotion and intuition rather than on reason and reflection. It was because of this that she adopted a strict line in regards to the territory that Israel stole in 1967. She didn't want to give it back. She was terrified at the prospect of being the first Israeli prime minister to willingly withdraw from land, and this motivated her behavior when dealing diplomatically or militarily with the Arabs. As she put it herself in her memoir while reminiscing on this period, "Intransigent was to become my middle name." As peace negotiations between Israel and its neighbors crumbled due to the failure to agree on an interpretation of Resolution 242, and as Israel's intransigence persisted, Gamal Abdel Nasser came to the realization that what was taken by force can only be recovered by force. He knew that the Israelis weren't interested in genuine peace talks and were just trying to stall as long as they could in order to fill the territories with settlers in the attempt to make facts on the ground and cozy into the territorial status quo. Nasser also couldn't allow for the Suez Canal to become the de facto border, and the major world powers were doing practically nothing to stop Israel's land theft. So, in March 1969, the War of Attrition officially began. Nasser's goals here were very limited. He confined his struggle to his own colonized lands in a liberatory effort to boot out the Israeli occupiers and to basically cause a scene in the region in order to provoke the world powers into doing something about Israel's behavior. Contrary to Zionist delusions pertaining to this period in history, Nasser was not trying to destroy Israel in 1969. He simply wanted to recover his own lands and obtain some help from the international community. Now, you may think you've just caught me in an act of hypocrisy and say, why are you okay with Nasser's use of force in 1969, but not Israel's use of force in 1967? Doesn't Article 2 of the UN Charter prohibit all use of force? And the answer is, no, not really. The UN Charter prohibits the use of force when it's directed against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. The Sinai Peninsula was undisputedly Egyptian territory, and Nasser's use of force was directed at his own land. John Quigley, in his book Palestine and Israel, recounts the argument made by the formative legal scholar and former president of the ICJ, R.Y. Jennings, and writes, "If a state recaptures its own territory by force, this is not an employment of force contrary to the provisions of Article 2.4 of the Charter. It cannot be force used against the territorial integrity or political independence of another state because the actor state is merely occupying its own territory." Jennings relied on the UN Charter definition of aggression as force used against the territorial integrity or political independence of a state. In addition to this, the aforementioned 1967 Security Council Resolution 242 explicitly prohibits the acquisition of territory by war. Not only did Israel acquire the Sinai, the Golan Heights, East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza through war, it immediately began to colonize these territories and engaged with diplomacy in terrible faith. In 1969, Nasser acted in self-defense in the face of an intransigent colonial occupier. The way Israel responded to this move from Egypt was to initiate deep penetration bombing of the Egyptian hinterland using American Phantom jets. From January to April 1970, Israel dropped about 8,000 tons of ordnance on the Nile Delta and the outskirts of Cairo, inflicting massive civilian casualties, including the deaths of about 100 steel workers at a plant at Abu Sabah, as well as dozens of school children. I guess some things never change. Despite this Israeli barbarity, Nasser still tried multiple times to advance diplomacy between the parties involved. For example, in February of 1970, he gave an interview to Le Monde and said, "It will be possible to establish a lasting peace between Israel and the Arab countries, not excluding economic and diplomatic relations, at such time as a satisfactory solution will have been reached on the two sole problems that are the causes of the current conflict, the occupied territories and Palestinian refugees." Golda Meir rejected this olive branch. 2 months later, in April of 1970, Nasser tried again, and he proposed the idea to invite the prominent Zionist leader of the World Jewish Congress, Nahum Goldman, to Egypt to explore diplomacy and a potential settlement. But the Israeli government vetoed this visit, rejecting yet another overture. By this point, the severity of the Egyptian bombings of Egypt caught the attention of the Soviet Union, which agreed to help Nasser by deploying 15,000 military personnel, 200 pilots, and advanced surface-to-air missile batteries to properly defend Egypt's interior from Israeli bombs. This Soviet intervention was actually the reason that the US decided to get more directly involved in ending the War of Attrition, since it now posed a risk of turning into a Cold War flashpoint. In June of 1970, US Secretary of State William Rogers put forth the second iteration of his peace proposal, known as the Rogers Plan B. This plan called for a 90-day ceasefire, a military standstill along the Suez Canal, and a renewed commitment by all parties to work toward the implementation of Security Council Resolution 242 via peace talks under the auspices of UN envoy Gunnar Jarring. Nasser agreed to this plan on July 22, 1970, while Golda Meir's initial reaction was to reject it. This is an important detail to drive home, since accepting Rogers B meant that one was accepting Resolution 242 and, by extension, openly agreeing to peace and recognition with all states involved. To put it simply, the Zionist delusions that Nasser never accepted peace and recognition with Israel are false. He publicly accepted 242 before Israel did. Now, whether or not he should have ever agreed to potentially recognize the Zionist colonial entity is a different discussion, and the factors that led him to even consider such a move should be understood, but the historical record clearly shows that he did. Golda, on the other hand, had to be bribed into accepting Rogers B. She initially and instinctively rejected the plan specifically because it required Israel to abide by Resolution 242 and withdraw from the land it had stolen. For her to reluctantly agree, US President Richard Nixon effectively had to buy her support with a series of written guarantees. He promised that, contrary to what Resolution 242 stipulated pertaining to the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war, Israel would not have to withdraw a single soldier until it was satisfied with the terms of a peace treaty. He also pledged massive economic and military aid and assured her that the United States would not force a solution to the Palestinian refugee issue that would alter the Jewish character of Israel. In other words, he promised not to support the Palestinians' internationally recognized right to return to the homes they had been violently expelled from in 1948. Taken together, these American concessions diluted the Rogers Plan so extensively that the Israelis were effectively agreeing to something fundamentally different from what the Arabs believed they were agreeing to. Nonetheless, the Israeli cabinet voted to accept Rogers B on July 31st, 1970, and on August 7th, the ceasefire clause went into effect, bringing the war of attrition to an end. Despite the fact that the Rogers Plan was supposed to usher the parties into a series of peace talks under the auspices of Gunnar Jarring, those talks were quickly put on hold. Nasser had moved his surface-to-air missile batteries slightly east to secure a stronger defensive position against Israeli aerial attacks in the events that hostilities resumed, as well as to gain leverage for the upcoming negotiations. You could argue he probably shouldn't have done this since it violated the standstill clause of the Rogers Plan, and Israel pointed to that violation as justification for abandoning the talks altogether. Now, Israel never really wanted those peace talks to begin with, so it used Nasser's violation as a pretext to abandon them when, in reality, it was already committed to its intransigence and the maintenance of the territorial status quo. Golda Meir had no interest in budging. I mean, if I were the leader of a state occupying multiple foreign lands, and I'd just been given the opportunity to secure peace and recognition with my most powerful adversary, and I genuinely wanted peace, would I throw that opportunity away simply because they moved some equipment within their own territory? Come on. It wasn't until December of 1970, after Nasser died of a heart attack that September and was succeeded by Anwar Sadat, that Israel, following protracted negotiations with Washington, ostensibly agreed to resume the Jarring talks. As the fighting ceased but the political deadlock remained, Golda Meir decided to lean even further into her role as an intransigent. It didn't help that, around this time in the US, an individual by the name of Henry Kissinger, who was serving as National Security Advisor, began advocating for a prolonged stalemate. His philosophy, unfortunately, became the prevailing American approach to Israel and its neighbors at the time, and even undercut the aspirations of US Secretary of State William Rogers, who was not a fan of this approach. Little did Rogers know that, in a couple years, Kissinger would succeed him as Secretary of State in September of 1973. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself. Kissinger believed that if Israel refused to cooperate with peace negotiations or diplomacy and simply militarily maintained the deadlock and territorial status quo, meaning its illegal occupation, the Arabs would eventually give up and become willing to strike a deal favorable to Israel. He also believed that through Israeli intransigence and military domination in the MENA region, the US would be able to weaken the Soviets and their regional allies. It was a stupid fucking plan. But Kissinger should not be solely blamed. The Israelis were just as culpable. In the words of Ben-Ami, who, need I remind you, is a proud and open Zionist himself, Golda Meir was to make things even worse. She was a self-righteous, intransigent, and stubborn Iron Lady who turned political inaction and righteousness into a system of government. Her unwillingness to question the position of the complacent military and the support she received from her close relations with President Nixon, who was more concerned with the task of curbing Soviet penetration into the Middle East than with the need to advance an Arab-Israeli peace, made her premiership one of almost inevitable decline towards war. It was precisely because of this that Anwar Sadat's multiple peace overtures were ignored. See, in February of 1971, UN envoy Gunnar Jarring, who was supposed to mediate the peace negotiations between Israel and its neighbors, proposed identical memoranda to both Egypt and Israel in an attempt to get some diplomacy going. He requested that Egypt commit to entering into a formal peace treaty with Israel and that Israel commit to withdrawing its forces to the former pre-1967 international border. Basically, he was telling them to work toward implementing Security Council Resolution 242. Egypt, on February 15, 1971, replied to Jarring's proposals with, "Egypt will be ready to enter into a peace agreement with Israel containing all aforementioned obligations provided for in Security Council Resolution 242. Once again, whether they should or shouldn't have is another discussion, but the Egyptians did agree to a comprehensive peace with Israel and the recognition of its borders as stipulated in 242. So, let's see how the Israelis responded, since their entire mythology is based around this delusion that Israel just wants peace with its neighbors while the Arabs don't. Well, Israel rejected Jarring's proposals because they didn't want to return to the pre-67 borders. Shocker. As a matter of fact, earlier that month, Anwar Sadat also independently proposed an interim settlement. He offered to reopen the Suez Canal to international shipping and extend the existing ceasefire if Israel agreed to a mere partial withdrawal of its troops from the eastern bank of the canal. Sadat's goal here was to propose this interim step as the first stage in a process leading toward the full implementation of Resolution 242. Israel rejected this too. So, to really drive home what the landscape looked like in February of 1971, Sadat first embarked on a solo initiative by putting forward a settlement proposal that would have required Israel to partially withdraw its troops from the Egyptian territory it was colonizing in exchange for reopening the canal as an attempt to work toward a comprehensive peace in stages. Golda Meir rejected this proposal, arguing that she wasn't interested in pursuing peace in stages and would only withdraw Israeli troops in the context of a comprehensive peace agreement. Then, just a few days later, Egypt agreed to Jarring's proposals to enter into a full comprehensive peace with Israel in exchange for getting back its own stolen land, and Israel rejected that too because it didn't want to give the land back. What the fuck was Sadat supposed to do? As Avi Shlaim summarized with regards to the period leading up to the October War, Israel's principal aim was to perpetuate the status quo. The strategy of attrition was accompanied, logically enough, by a diplomacy of attrition. If the strategy of attrition was directed at perpetuating the territorial status quo, the diplomacy of attrition was directed at perpetuating the political deadlock. In September of 1973, the Israeli Labor government approved the Galili document. Named after the man who drafted it, Yisrael Galili, the document was meant to bridge the gap between the political moderates and hardliners within Israeli politics by getting them to bond over their shared favorite pastime, illegally settling land. The Galili Plan formally authorized a massive expansion of settlements in the occupied territories. It called for an increase in both the pace and scale of settlement construction, permitted private Israeli citizens to purchase land in the occupied territories, and even encouraged investment from Israeli industrialists. Now, don't get me wrong, this alone wasn't the reason why Sadat and Assad launched their campaign. They had actually already planned it before the Galili document was even presented. But that's because the Israelis had already been colonizing the territories since the wake of the 1967 war while refusing to engage in good faith negotiations, and they did this fully aware that they were violating the Fourth Geneva Convention. As historian Tom Segev points out in his book on the matter, Israel's own legal experts told the government that transferring its civilian population into the occupied territories was a violation of international law, and that didn't stop them. All the 1973 Galili Plan did was dramatically accelerate that settlement project in an attempt to create what the Israelis call facts on the ground and work toward the de facto annexation of the territories. The Egyptians and the Syrians were not going to stand for this brazen colonial aggression. Thus far, we've focused primarily on the dynamic between Israel and Egypt in the lead up to the October 1973 war, But the plight of the Syrians shouldn't be brushed over. During and after the 1967 Six-Day War, when Israel ignored a UN ceasefire to seize the Golan Heights, which it has held onto to this day, it subjected the Syrian population there to a massive campaign of ethnic cleansing. The Israeli military utilized napalm on multiple Syrian villages, initially causing around 35,000 Syrians to flee. Over the next 6 months, it violently expelled another 80 to 95,000 residents and leveled about 130 villages. Residents were denied food and water and threatened with execution if they refused to leave behind their homes or livestock. In the end, only about 5% of the original population remained, roughly 6 to 8,000 people, living in Druze villages since those were the ones spared. So, as the Syrians watched Israel engage in bad faith diplomacy while simultaneously expanding its illegal settlements across the territories it had seized, it's more than reasonable that Hafez al-Assad decided to join Anwar Sadat in an attempt to liberate their occupied lands by force. On October 6, 1973, Egypt and Syria launched their coordinated surprise campaign to recover the Sinai Peninsula and the Golan Heights. This campaign was strictly confined to the goal of liberating the occupied territories, and despite the occasional bellicose language, neither Sadat nor Assad were trying to destroy Israel. They both knew that such a goal was far beyond their military capabilities, and they worried it could trigger Israeli nuclear strikes. Their goal was primarily to break the political deadlock and force the major world powers to do something about Israeli occupation of their lands. The campaign took place on the Jewish religious holiday of Yom Kippur, and Zionists will point to this detail as though it's indicative of some sort of Arab anti-Semitism for taking advantage of a day of rest and fasting to get a one-up on the Jews. But these same people often fail to mention that the war also took place during a holy Muslim period of prayer and fasting, Ramadan. See, trying to distill this war, or even the broader Israeli-Arab situation, down to a religious conflict is misinformed. It primarily has to do with colonialism and land theft, not the theological differences between Islam and Judaism. Funnily enough, even Abba Iban refutes this narrative and actually expresses gratitude that the Egyptians and Syrians chose Yom Kippur to strike. He actually believed that they were unaware of the religious holiday when they struck, though historians like Eugene Rogan dispute this and argue that they did know that the attack would fall on Yom Kippur, but that their primary motivations had more to do with lunar and tidal conditions and the potential for a media blackout. Regardless, Abba Iban wrote in his memoir, "It later emerged that the Arab leaders who planned the war had not been aware of Yom Kippur at all. They had thought of such things as the full moon, the rate of flow in the canal, and Israeli preoccupation with the election. While our Day of Atonement was not in their consciousness, it was in fact imprudent of them to choose the day in which Israeli mobilization would be quicker than at any other time. The call-up of Israeli reserves faces two logistic difficulties: delay in locating reservists and congestion of communications. On Yom Kippur, an Israeli reservist can be found either in his home or in a synagogue, and the roads are open and free. Sadat had not done us any disservice by his choice of date." In the beginning of the war, the Israelis actually fared quite poorly. Their arrogance led them to believe that the Arabs would not dare launch a campaign to reclaim their lands, and they would eventually just roll over and accept Israeli settlement terms if Israel maintained the territorial status quo. In another display of Israeli hubris, their intelligence gathering units ignored warnings that war was coming. For example, when the traitor and Zionist collaborator King Hussein of Jordan warned the Israelis of Sadat and Assad's plans, the Israelis disregarded him. Following Israel's initial battlefield losses, like the Syrian liberation of part of the southern Golan Heights, as well as a small pocket in the north near Mount Hermon, and the collapse of the Bar Lev Line, the chain of Israeli fortifications along the eastern bank of the Suez Canal, the Israelis had to call up Big Brother USA and ask for help. The Syrian offensive was successfully halted and reversed before significant American aid could arrive, but when it did, it came in the form of tens of thousands of tons of supplies, including tanks, aircraft, and ammunition. Because of this American intervention, the Israelis were able to replenish their losses, restore their military strength, and sustain their later operations after the initial shock of war. On the Egyptian front, however, the Israelis were unable to dislodge the Egyptians from the eastern bank of the canal for the remainder of the war. This meant that, for the first time since 1967, the Egyptians were situated on both banks of the Suez Canal. Unfortunately, so were the Israelis. See, since they couldn't dislodge the Egyptians from the eastern bank, they went around them and dug into a little enclave on the western bank, meaning At the end of the war, things looked pretty messy with Egyptian and Israeli troops on both sides, but this was still a massive win for Egypt. The fighting lasted for about 3 weeks and ended with a ceasefire through UN Security Council Resolution 338, which was essentially just a reiteration of Resolution 242. Due to Egypt's gains during this war, as well as the shattering of the facade of Israeli military impenetrability, the Israelis were finally willing to come to the table and work toward a settlement. Contrary to the Zionist lie that the Israelis gave back the Sinai out of the goodness of their hearts, it actually took brute force from the colonized before Israel even considered its occupation untenable and decided to budge. The Sinai Disengagement of Forces Agreement was concluded in 1974, also known as Sinai 1, and returned the Suez Canal to Egyptian control, allowing Egypt to finally reopen it. It also set the parties involved onto a path that culminated in the full Israeli withdrawal from the Sinai, as well as a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel in 1979 at Camp David. It's worth mentioning that the Camp David Accords were actually less generous toward the Israelis than Sadat's original offerings in 1971, as they included at least some lip service toward Palestinian autonomy, though I'm still of the opinion that Sadat largely sold the Palestinians out. Israel finally completed its withdrawal from the bulk of Sinai in 1982, and you guessed it, immediately invaded Lebanon and occupied it for the next 18 years. Some things never change. Aside from what I would argue to be Assad and Sadat's moral right to reclaim their own lands by force, a strong argument can be made regarding the legality of their armed struggle. International jurists like Judge Fuad Amoun of the ICJ recognize that colonialism and alien occupation constitute a continuing aggression. Based on this understanding, Judge Amoun and other legal scholars have argued that the struggle for national liberation and self-determination can be viewed as a fundamentally defensive act that falls within the broader principle of self-defense recognized under Article 51 of the UN Charter. There's also the aforementioned R.Y. Jennings position that recapturing one's own territory by force does not necessarily violate Article 2.4 of the UN Charter because the use of force is not directed against the territorial integrity or political independence of another state, but rather toward ending an unlawful occupation. So even if the occasional Egyptian or Syrian missile was aimed at Israeli military equipment in mainland Israel during the 73 war, this still did not constitute a use of force directed at anything other than defending against an illegal occupation, one that did, in fact, constitute the continuation of an armed attack and a use of force contrary to the UN Charter. Furthermore, the 1971 ICJ ruling regarding South Africa's occupation of Namibia found that its continued presence had become illegal and it had forfeited the right to maintain its authority there. Legal scholars had applied this precedent to Israel and argued that Israel's refusal to negotiate an end to its occupation on the basis of international law delegitimized its continued presence and undermined the rights normally afforded to an occupying power. If we can look back at the armed struggle waged by SWAPO and other Namibian resistance fighters and approve of their just fight against their white supremacist occupiers, why wouldn't we feel the same way about the Arab resistance to their Israeli Jewish supremacist occupiers? It's the same principle. Nonetheless, it's because of this moral argument and the strong legal case made within the anti-colonial framework that the international community understood why Egypt and Syria launched their campaign, and the UN Security Council never condemned it. Abba Iban himself acknowledged the attitude of the international community in the wake of the October War. The Egyptian attack on Israel on Yom Kippur aroused no international revulsion. Not a single government accused Egypt of aggression. In 1973, Egypt was deemed to be fighting for the restoration of its own territory after fruitless attempts to achieve that aim by diplomacy, he wrote in his memoir, while also acknowledging that Israel's measures for ruling the occupied territories were punitive and the lack of rapport between rulers and ruled was no less marked than in colonial regimes. As an anti-Zionist, it sometimes feels futile to even embark on these massive projects of disproving Israeli narratives because my actual position is that the nation-state of Israel should never have come into existence as it could never have been established without the expulsion of the existing indigenous society. I wish I could just leave my argument at that, but that usually isn't enough to change someone's mind, so I think it's important to get into the details surrounding Zionist mythology and demonstrate that even on their own grounds of argumentation, the truth prevails if you actually seek it out. That's all for today. As you could probably tell, these videos take a really long time and require a lot of reading to make, so if you don't want to wait months in between uploads, I post frequently on my second channel, Under Zealots, and I co-host a weekly podcast called No Politic Here, so you could catch me there. Thank you to my patrons on Patreon, with a special written thanks to those top-tier supporters. If you want access to my scripts and source material in an organized fashion, as well as other perks, consider becoming a patron. Thanks.
And just like that, we arrive at the final breaths of this week's broadcast. The lantern lowering its glow. The truth settling into the room after an hour that demanded courage, clarity, and an open heart. As you step back into your day, may the questions that surfaced here refuse to be buried. May the courage stirred within you refuse to fade. And may the curiosity that keeps truth alive continue to burn in a world that works tirelessly to smother it.
I'm Maria Sultan, your host and narrator. Sharing this hour with you has been an honor. An hour rooted in dignity, in clarity, and in a solidarity that does not evaporate when headlines shift or when cameras turn away. If something you heard today unsettled you, challenged you, or cracked open a door you didn't know existed, and if you ever feel the pull to lend your own voice to this work, know that this space will always have room for you.
You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com.
To you, our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, your willingness to walk this difficult path beside us. Your presence is living proof that truth still matters, that memory still matters, that resistance still matters. If you missed any part of today's program, you could explore our full archive on radio4all.net and archive.org. You also can find us on every major platform: YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Overcast, Castro, Podchaser, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. Just search This Week in Palestine, or TWIP, and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory sign.
We are also featured on KKRN. 88.5 FM, community radio in Shasta County, California. Streaming at kkrn.org anywhere. You can catch the show every Monday at 4 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. Spread the word. Tell your friends. Let the signal travel.
We're also featured on Million Podcasts, a platform uplifting Arab American creators and helping listeners discover new voices. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care. Stay grounded. Stay steadfast. This is This Week in Palestine. This is occupied land. This is Palestine. And the call for freedom continues. Free Palestine, from the river to the sea. Palestine, Hurrah.